Translation. By His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jaya. That Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, in the guise of all-devouring time, Kala Rupa, has now descended on earth to eliminate the envious from the world. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. There are two classes of human beings, namely the envious and the obedient. Since the Supreme Lord is one, and the Father of all living beings, the envious living beings are also his sons. But they are known as the Asuras. But the living beings who are obedient to the Supreme Father are called Devatas or demigods, because they are not contaminated by the material conception of life. Not only are the Asuras envious of the Lord in even denying the existence of the Lord, but they are also envious of all other living beings. The predominance of Asuras in the world is occasionally rectified by the Lord when he eliminates them from the world and establishes a rule of Devatas like the Pandavas. His designation as Kala in disguise is significant. He is not at all dangerous, but he is the transcendental form of eternity, knowledge and bliss. For the devotees, his factual form is disclosed, and for the non-devotees, he appears like Kala Rupa, which is causal form. This causal form of the Lord is not at all pleasing to the Asuras, and therefore they think of the Lord as formless in order to feel secure that they will not be vanquished by the Lord. So yamadya maharaja bhagavan bhuta bhavanaha kala rupa vatirno syam abhavaya suradvisham. That Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, in the guise of all devouring time, Kala Rupa, has now descended on earth to eliminate the envious from the world. Om Agyan Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chaksho Umilitam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Apitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shiyuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakan Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bando Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gorangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpa Turubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Forget the past that sleeps, and ne'er the future dream at all. Stay with times that are with thee, and progress thou shalt call. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he wrote this little poem, and I thought it was relevant. That's the first thing that occurred to me when I read this translation and purport, because the main theme is about time. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, in the guise of all-devouring time, Kala Rupa, has now descended on earth to eliminate the envious from the world. So I was thinking about all-devouring time. So, actually, there's two main topics in this purport. The first one is about two types of living beings, the devas and the asuras, and and how the Lord then comes to wipe out at various times. He says occasionally, only occasionally, the Lord appears to eliminate the predominance of asuras from the world and establish a rule of devatas like the Pandavas. So how does he do this? He does it sometimes by coming personally, but sometimes also, well, actually most of the time, through all-devouring time, Kala Rupa. So this is mainly actually what I wanted to focus on, because I found a very nice article written by one of the most prominent and greatest philosophers within ISKCON, His Grace Ravindra Swarup Prabhu. He has a PhD in theology, and he's, as I say, is a philosopher, as well as a GBC guru. So I just wanted to let you know that, because what I'm going to speak is not coming from me. Because if you may not accept it if it was, but because it's coming from Ravindra Swarup. So I found it very interesting, very thought-provoking, as I said before. So I want to see how you respond to this. It's not so long, but it's got some very striking points, which I think are worth dwelling on and trying to think about. So because we're all affected by time. Is anybody here not affected by time? No, we're all affected by it. There's no question about that. And, of course, this is Krishna's energy. One thing that Srila Prabhupada does say towards the end of this purport is that Krishna is not at all dangerous. Of course, we don't think of him as danger. We think of him as our best friend. But he is the transcendental form of eternity, knowledge, and bliss. So how can the transcendental form of eternity, knowledge, and bliss be dangerous? Well, for the devotees, he's not. Prabhupada says, for the devotees, his factual form is disclosed. His factual form. So what is Krishna's factual form? That is the form of eternity, knowledge, and bliss in Vrindavan, playing his flute, having wonderful pastimes with Srimati Radharani, the gopis, the cowherd boys, all the inhabitants of Vrindavan. That is his factual form. And for the non-devotees, he appears like Kala Rupa, which is causal form. So I was wondering, what does that mean, causal form? He is causal form. Maybe you can think about it for a few seconds. What is causal form? It's not his factual form. His factual form is in Vrindavan, Goloka Vrindavan. But it's his causal form. So the conclusion I came to meditating on this, that causal form means his energy, which he has, which is expanded from him in order to cause the creation. Because, of course, at the beginning of creation, there is only the pradhan. The pradhan is just like a big soup. Everything's mixed up altogether. There's no distinctions. But at the time of creation, the Lord, he glances, his glance, impregnates the pradhan with three things. The living entities, their karma, and time. Yeah, time. So that's why Kala Rupa is his causal form. He goes on to say, this causal form of the Lord is not at all pleasing to the asuras. And therefore they think of the Lord as formless in order to feel secure that they will not be vanquished by the Lord. So why do the Asuras not feel pleased by the causal form of the Lord? Well, because it's actually destruction, isn't it? Time is all devouring, death, destruction. Everything comes to an end. So at least that's our conception of time in this material world. But that's what we're going to examine a little bit more. But if one is an Asura, then that is actually the most dominant factor of life, time, isn't it? You know, beginning, middle, end. And it's inescapable. Time is totally inescapable. Of course, the other topic is about devotees and the demoniac. And of course, if we turn to the Bhagavad Gita, the chapter 16, we see that Krishna has analyzed very elaborately, actually, what distinguishes a devotee or somebody of divine nature and somebody of demoniac nature. And of course, he lists 26 qualities in the first verse, actually, the first few verses. How many? Three verses. He lists 26 qualities. I'm not going to go through them because maybe later if we have time. But then he explains what is the basic difference. Can anybody tell me what is the actual distinguishing feature between just one thing? If you were to select just one thing, what does Krishna say in the 16th chapter? Is the main difference? Pride? Well, what he says in the 16th chapter is that the devotees accept the Shastras and the demons don't. So everything then comes from that. All the demoniac qualities come because we don't accept, because we think we're independent, we're self-reliant, we've got it all together ourselves. So, and of course, there's one verse which explains the symptoms of a sadhu. Tatikshava Kurunika, Suhridam Savadehinam, Ajata Shatrava Shanta, Sadhava Sarubhushanaha. So, Sadhava means actually he abides by the scriptures. So a devotee or a sadhu, he abides by the scriptures. Sadhubhushana, and all his therefore all his characteristics are divine. Or sublime, actually, is a translation to that. So we obviously we are aspiring devotees. So therefore we want to develop the good qualities. So the basis of it is Shastra, Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu. So one Sadhu, as I explained, is Ravindra Swarup Prabhu. He doesn't come here very often. I don't remember him actually coming here, Ravindra Swarup. So you may not know him. But he's a very learned devotee. And he wrote this article, and it actually ties in very nicely with the theme of this purport. Because he's talking about unconceiving the inconceivable. Now, and also some principles in understanding the origin of the conditioned soul. So the conditioned souls basically are the non-devotees, and the pure devotees are in the spiritual world. So he starts off by saying, we conditioned souls are originally Krishna-conscious living entities. But owing to a desire to be independent of God and to be the supreme ourselves, we have fallen from our original position. So this is the first thing. We're originally Krishna conscious, but we desire to be independent, so therefore we've fallen from our original position. And of course, this is quite sometimes a controversial subject. And we've become covered by Maya, illusion, who provides us with false identities of gross and subtle matter. By the grace of Krishna and his pure devotees, we fallen souls can regain our original Krishna consciousness and in doing so go back to Godhead. So this is the basic narrative, he calls it, a dramatic narrative. We are originally Krishna-conscious living entities, but somehow we got an desire to be independent of God, and therefore we've fallen from our original position. But by the grace of Krishna and his pure devotees, we can regain our original Krishna-consciousness. So that's the basic narrative he starts with. So he says that this story is the profoundest truth about ourselves, and there is no fault in it. But this story becomes complicated when we discover from the same shastric sources, identical infallible sources, that the souls in the spiritual world are nitya siddha, eternally or perpetually liberated souls, and that no one falls from the spiritual world. No one falls from the spiritual world. Further, the souls in the material world are nitya baddha, eternally or perpetually conditioned, and we learn that their conditioned state is anadi, or without any beginning. These statements also are true without a doubt. So this could be a little bit challenging, daunting, that those in the spiritual world are always there, they never fall down, and those in the material world are nitya baddha, always here, like that. So this may seem a little contrary to understanding that we have to go back home, back to Godhead. So how can these facts be reconciled with the story of fall and redemption? Because that's what we started with, fall and redemption. We fall, but we can actually get back. Okay? So he says that it's necessary to recognize that the seemingly straightforward linear narrative of time is more complicated than it appears, because the narrative scope of action spans two worlds, one eternal and the other temporal. So the spiritual world is eternal, the material world, temporal. Its limit has a beginning and an end. So he says that we can get some sense of the connection, the relation between these two worlds, if we recollect the temporal structure of the material universe as presented in Srimad Bhagavatam. Actually, I was going to go through, but it's not really time, the third canto, chapter 11, which is all about time, explains all, a whole chapter is about time. Maitreya Muni is explaining. But anyway, it's probably not necessary. As one ascends from Martyaloka, this means this world, the world of death, through Svargaloka, the plane of enjoying and administrating demigods, and further through Mahaloka and so on, to Satyaloka, time progressively dilates. And I'll explain what that means. Time dilates. Thus, as 360 years go by here in Martyaloka, only a year passes for the devas in Svargaloka. And 300 billion years have to come and go down here for a single year to transpire in Satyaloka for Lord Brahma. 300 billion years is 1 year for Lord Brahma. Okay, so that sets the scene. Srimad Bhagavatam mentions that when Brahma, this is just some evidence of it, kidnapped the cowherd boys and calves from Krishna, the victims were gone How long? 1 year, according to our experience. But for Brahma, how long was it? A truti. Yeah, that's why I was going to go through this chapter 11 of the third canto, because it explains the basic component of time is called paramanu, an atom. But a truti, anyway, he explains here, a truti lasts, do you know, anybody know how long a truti lasts? I wouldn't expect, I couldn't remember without, I've got it in front of me, but if you divide 1 second by 13,500, that comes out to about, I've worked it out the other day, it comes out to about 0.00075 of a second. So if you multiply that by 8, which is still only like 0.0005, something like that, of a second. So a very short time. So that's how long had passed for Lord Brahma when he stole the cowherd boys. Not long at all. But it was long enough for him, anyway, to... On another occasion, you can probably remember this, another occasion, there was a Maharaj Kakugni seeking a husband for his daughter, Revati. And he took her to Satyaloka to ask Lord Brahma to arrange the match. But Brahma kept them waiting until he'd finished hearing a recital by the Gandhava musicians. And then when Kakugni finally presented his request, Brahma burst out laughing. Jai Shri Shri Radha Gokula Nanda Ki Jai Shri Shri Sita Ram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai Shri Shri Gonita Ki Jai. So Brahma started laughing. Why? Because everyone that Kakugni would have wanted for his daughter as a husband was long gone. How long had passed in that time, which was in Brahma's time was only a few minutes, I expect, but 27 yuga cycles had passed. How long is that? 160 million years. While they've been waiting, you know, in the foyer, in the anteroom. So this is just to set the scene. Now he gives a very interesting analogy. He says, if there was a live television broadcast on Satyaloka, in Lord Brahma's realm, he can see anyway what's going on. But if we were on Satyaloka and there was a live TV broadcast of our Earth here or of Matyaloka, then what we would find is that you would see mountains rising, oceans swelling over, and shrinking, people and civilizations coming in and going out very fast. Just imagine it. You can just picture it in your mind. Mountains are rising, going down, oceans are filling up and dispersing, and, you know, people, empires are coming and going, all in just a few seconds, you'd see, like that. So that's an interesting way to think of it. Just like, you know, for an ant, you know, it's crawling on the ground here. And for it, it probably seems like a long time that it's crawling there. But for us, it's just a few seconds. On the other hand, if we were to have a television broadcast coming from Satyaloka, what would it be like? It would be like grass growing. Grass is growing. Something's happening, but you can't see it, can you? So it would seem like nothing was happening at all. But of course, things are happening. Lord Brahma's there. He's doing there. He's hearing recitals by the Kandava musicians and things. So in order to be able to actually perceive what's happening there, you would have to have time-lapse photography. In other words, okay, you take a photograph now, and then in 1,000 years you take another photograph, and then another 1,000 years. So eventually, And then you just put those together, and then you would actually experience what may be happening, because it's everything speeded up like that. Okay? So keep all this in mind, and imagine the temporal structure of the universe. Now, here, I want you to use your imagination. There's a triangle, an equilateral triangle like this. Okay? Got that? A triangle with equal sides. its width at the bottom, at the base, stands for the duration of the universe in our years. So what is that? How many years? Lord Brahma's lifetime is how long? 311,040,000,000,000 years. Don't forget the 40 billion, you know. It sounds like it's just an add-on, but it's a long time. So that's the base of the triangle. 311,040,000,000,000 years. As we go up the triangle, so at the level of Brahma, the duration of the universe, still depicted as the width of the triangle, is 100 of his years. So like that. Now you continue up the universe past Satyaloka. The unit measure of duration continues to dilate. It seems to get smaller. Time slows more and more. Remember, we've got, you know, this time-lapse photography in Satyaloka. And finally, at the point where the material realm borders the spiritual realm, time has its stop. Time stops at that point. At the apex of the triangle, time stops. Okay? Here, at the apex of the triangle, we reach the point of translation between material and spiritual world, between time and eternity. Got that point? So, the material world, like this, and then it's the spiritual world. This is what he says in inverted commas, the now moment of eternity. An everlasting instant without past or future. You got that? An everlasting instant without past and without future. Which is an interesting concept. Try to keep that in mind. I've got an advantage because I've read this several times to try and understand. We have seen how when we go up the universe, a unit measure of time includes more and more of our years. When that happens, when we take that process to the limit, as we do when we reach the what happens when we reach the apex? That single climactic moment embodies time without beginning and end. Okay? From this point of view, the lifetimes of a trillion Brahmas are over as soon as they begin. Who can even express such inconceivable things? Ravindra Sarup says. So I hope I've not lost you. Any questions so far? Yeah. I mean, just for clarification, basically.
Very, very interesting points, Prabhu. Thank you so much for that.
I haven't finished.
You haven't finished. So you want to let the questions in the end, or you?
Well, I'm just asking the question now, just in case anybody doesn't understand how far we've got. Not. Yeah, you can leave for the end.
Because you asked for questions. Okay.
Fine. But if anybody needs, you know, some help in understanding, I can try. So. The next part is, if we were to continue with our figure of a triangle, we would have to envisage the two lines of its sides extending through the apex to form a second inverted triangle. Okay? You've got two triangles now. So the top one is upside down. The apex is at the bottom and the wide part is at the top. Okay? Let this triangle, with its base up and its apex down, signify the spiritual realm of transcendental variegatedness as it expands beyond the zero point of nirvana. The figure of the two triangles, apex to apex, is simply another representation of what the Bhagavad Gita signifies by the metaphor of an inverted tree, a reflection of the original tree standing on the water's bank. So like we have the banyan tree in the 15th chapter, like that. So that's what the comparison is making. Okay, but this in terms of time. So he says, our minds boggle even at the now moment of eternity, of the impersonal speculators. So this is the point which the impersonal speculators reach. Even further from our conceptions is a realm in which transcendental time, which has neither past nor future, allows for activities, pastimes, and ever-increasing qualities of beauty, joy, and knowledge. So the point here is that for the impersonalists, that's where everything stops. That's why he said at this point of nirvana. There's no activity. Everything's just here and now. Like there's one author, impersonalist, I think, who says, be here now. He's written a book. Like, I think, is it called that? Be here now. And that's the whole idea, that actually everything is one. Everything. So, and time is one. There's no past and there's no future. So it is some kind of realization, but it doesn't go far enough. Now, to consider the issue before us, we must not only contemplate that inconceivable eternal realm, but we must think about it in relationship with our world of past, passing, and to come. Let us proceed to do so. As we have seen, the transcendental realm is eternal, present, an everlasting instant. You remember that? It's an everlasting instant. One instant. Where are we? All right. Every soul in that realm must accordingly be characterized as Nitya Mukta, eternally liberated. Do you get that point? Because everything is an eternal instant, right here and now, everybody that's within that instant must always have been there. They never had any time when they went there, and they never have any time when they go there, leave there. Okay? This includes the souls that come from the material world. For if a soul enters that realm from the material world, can we ask, when did that soul arrive? The question does not apply. Once the soul gets there, that soul can only be Nitya Mukta. He has necessarily always been there. This is the logic of eternity. Does that make sense? Okay, so we'll carry on. Now let us go to a matter equally inconceivable. Let us say, for the purposes of discussion, that a soul falls from eternity and sojourns in the material world. Because our experience is that that happens. Okay? When did he enter the material world? That is the question. We can only say that the fall is a non-temporal act that renders the conditioned soul bound from all time. The history of his incarceration in time has no beginning. The conditioned soul has always been conditioned. Strictly speaking, the question of when does not apply. Although bondage is not the soul's original condition, the state of bondage is necessarily described as anadi, or beginningless, and the conditioned soul himself is characterized as nityabada, eternally bound or conditioned. There was no time when he was not bound. Don't worry, it gets resolved. I hope you don't mind if I just go a bit over time. Yet such souls can attain release and enter the spiritual realm. Okay, such souls can attain release and enter the spiritual realm. Let us say that the soul who has fallen from that realm into beginningless bondage now returns. The duration of that bondage spans time without limit, as we have seen. Yet now, if we inquire from the perspective of eternity, how long has that fallen and restored soul been absent? The answer is, he never left. Or alternatively, the question does not apply. For the logic of eternity dictates that no one falls from eternity, even if he does so. The logic of eternity also dictates that no conditioned soul can begin his eternal life. There's no beginning. Even though he does so, in considering both falling from and returning to transcendence, we must accept the logic of eternity to be true to what is real. Okay? There's no beginning, there's no end. It's an eternal instant. Thus, we see that while it is true that no one falls from the spiritual world, we in fact have done so, and yet there is no contradiction. Okay, I'll finish off. The dramatic narration of a life with God, a fall from that life, a sojourn in the alien world of illusion, and a final restoration to God is not a fiction. It is a profound truth, i.e., falling and then being restored. It's a profound truth. It need not be rejected on the mistaken notion that it conflicts with other equally true statements of authorities. For our better understanding, however, we need to be aware of one simplification that takes place quite naturally in the telling of narrative of fall and redemption. This is the representation of all the events in the story as though they take place on a single temporal continuum. For example, we habitually characterize our entry into time as though it were itself a temporal occasion, a datable event. However, as we have seen, once we become conditioned, we have always been conditioned. Similarly, we think of our rebellion against God as a distant aboriginal event. Aboriginal means primary, original. One that took place long ago and far away in that world. In truth, that single act of rebellion is perpetual. The very same aboriginal event is taking place right now. We have only to look into our hearts to confirm this. Okay. Furthermore, when we return to the spiritual world, it will only be to discover that indeed, what? We never left. And there has always been right here. We are right now with Krishna. For Krishna consciousness is our swarup, our eternal identity. We need only wake up and see where we are. All this is known to Srila Prabhupada and to the Acharyas, previous teachers. They know how one can fall from a place no one falls from, enter into ignorance that has always been, and return to a place one never actually left. Because such matters are inconceivable to mundane minds, when teachers speak of such things, their words may seem contradictory. But in one way or another, they all tell the whole truth. Ravindra Prabhu ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Any questions?